18. Popeye drove swiftly, but without any quality of haste or of flight, down the clay road and into the sand. Temple was beside him. Her hat was jammed onto the back of her head, her hair escaping beneath the crumpled brim in matted clots. Her face looked like a sleepwalker's as she swayed limply to the lurching of the car. She lurched against Popeye, lifting her hand in limp reflex. Without releasing the wheel, he thrust her back with his elbow. "Brace yourself," he said. "Come on now." Before they came to the tree, they passed the woman. She stood beside the road carrying the child, the hem of her dress folded back over its face. And she looked at them quietly from beneath the faded sunbonnet, flicking swiftly in and out of Temple's vision without any motion, any sign. When they reached the tree, Popeye swung the car out of the road and drove it crashing into the undergrowth and through the prone treetop and back into the road again, in a running popping of cane stalks like musketry along a trench, without any diminution of speed. Beside the tree, Gowan's car lay on its side. Temple looked vaguely and stupidly at it, as it too shot behind. Popeye swung back into the sandy ruts. Yet there was no flight in the action. He performed it with a certain vicious petulance. That was all. It was a powerful car. Even in the sand, it held 40 miles an hour and up the narrow gulch to the high road where he turned north. Sitting beside him, braced against jolts that had already given way to a smooth increasing hiss of gravel, Temple gazed dully forward as the road she had traversed yesterday began to flee backward under the wheels as onto a spool, feeling her blood seeping slowly inside her loins. She sat limp in the corner of the seat, watching the steady backward rush of the land. Pines in opening vistas splashed with fading dogwood, sedge, fields green with new cotton and empty of any movement, peaceful, as though Sunday were a quality of atmosphere, of light and shade. Sitting with her legs close together, listening to the hot, minute seeping of her blood, saying dully to herself, "I'm still bleeding. I'm still bleeding." It was a bright, soft day. A wanton morning filled with that unbelievable soft radiance of May, rife with a promise of noon and of heat, with high, fat clouds like gobs of whipped cream floating lightly as reflections in a mirror, their shadows scudding sedately across the road. It had been a lavender spring. The fruit trees, the white ones, had been in small leaf when the blooms matured. They had never attained that brilliant whiteness of last spring, and the dogwood had come into full bloom after the leaf also, in green retrograde before crescendo. But lilac and wisteria and redbud, even the shabby heaven trees, had never been finer, fulgent, with a burning scent blowing for 100 yards along the vagrant air of April and May. The bougainvillea against the veranda would be large as basketballs and lightly poised as balloons, and looking vacantly and stupidly at the rushing roadside, Temple began to scream. It started as a wail, rising, cut suddenly off by Popeye's hand. With her hands lying on her lap, sitting erect, she screamed, tasting the gritty acridity of his fingers, while the car slewed squealing in the gravel, feeling her secret blood. Then he gripped her by the back of the neck, and she sat motionless, her mouth round and open like a small, empty cave. He shook her head. "Shut it," he said. "Shut it," gripping her silent. "Look at yourself. Here." With the other hand, he swung the mirror on the windshield around, and she looked at her image, at the up-tilted hat and her matted hair and her round mouth. She began to fumble at her coat pockets, looking at her reflection. He released her, and she produced the compact and opened it and peered into the mirror, whimpering a little. She powdered her face and rouged her mouth and straightened her hat, whimpering into the tiny mirror on her lap while Popeye watched her. He lit a cigarette. "Ain't you ashamed of yourself?" he said.
"It's still running," she whimpered. "I can feel it."
With the lipstick poised, she looked at him and opened her mouth again. He gripped her by the back of the neck.
"Stop it now. You gonna shut it?"
"Yes," she whimpered.
"See you do then. Come on, get yourself fixed."
She put the compact away. He started the car again. The road began to thicken with pleasure cars, Sunday bent. Small, clay-crusted Fords and Chevrolets, an occasional larger car moving swiftly with swathed women and dust-covered hampers, trucks filled with wooden-faced country people in garments like a colored wood meticulously carved, now and then a wagon or a buggy. Before a weathered frame church on a hill, the grove was full of tethered teams and battered cars and trucks. The woods gave away to fields. Houses became more frequent. Low above the skyline, above roofs and a spire or two, smoke hung. The gravel became asphalt, and they entered Dumfries. Temple began to look about, like one waking from sleep.
"Not here," she said. "I can't."
"Hush it now," Popeye said.
"I can't. I might," she whimpered. "I'm hungry," she said. "I haven't eaten since."
"Ah, you ain't hungry. Wait till we get to town."
She looked about with dazed, glassy eyes.
"There might be people here."
He swung in toward a filling station.
"I can't get out," she whimpered. "It's still running, I tell you."
"Who told you to get out?"
He descended and looked at her across the wheel.
"Don't you move."
She watched him go up the street and enter a door. It was a dingy confectionery. He bought a pack of cigarettes and put one in his mouth.
"Give me a couple of bars of candy," he said.
"What kind?"
"Candy," he said.
Under a glass bell on the counter, a plate of sandwiches sat. He took one and flipped a dollar on the counter and turned toward the door. "Here's your change," the clerk said.
"Keep it," he said. "You'll get rich faster."
When he saw the car, it was empty. He stopped 10 feet away and changed the sandwich to his left hand. The unlighted cigarette slanted beneath his chin. The mechanic, hanging the hose up, saw him and jerked his thumb toward the corner of the building. Beyond the corner, the wall made an offset. In the niche was a greasy barrel half full of scraps of metal and rubber. Between the barrel and the wall, Temple crouched.
"He nearly saw me," she whispered. "He was almost looking right at me."
"Who?"
Popeye said. He looked back up the street.
"Who saw you?"
"He was coming right toward me, a boy at school. He was looking right toward—"
"Come on, come out of it."
"He was look—"
Popeye took her by the arm. She crouched in the corner, jerking at the arm he held, her wan face craned around the corner.
"Come on now."
Then his hand was at the back of her neck, gripping it.
"Oh,"
she wailed in a choked voice. It was as though he were lifting her slowly erect by that one hand, excepting that there was no movement between them. Side by side, almost of a height, they appeared as decorous as two acquaintances stopped to pass the time of day before entering church.
"Are you coming?" he said. "Are you?"
"I can't. It's down to my stocking now. Look."
She lifted her skirt away in a shrinking gesture. Then she dropped the skirt and rose again, her torso arching backward, her soundless mouth open as he gripped her. He released her.
"Will you come now?"
She came out from behind the barrel. He took her arm.
"It's all over the back of my coat," she whimpered. "Look and see."
"You're all right. I'll get you another coat tomorrow." Come on.
They returned to the car. At the corner, she hung back again.
You want some more of it, do you?
He whispered, not touching her.
Do you?
She went on and got into the car quietly. He took the wheel.
Here. I got you a sandwich.
He took it from his pocket and put it in her hand.
Come on now. Eat it.
She took a bite obediently. He started the car and took the Memphis road. Again, the bitten sandwich in her hand. She ceased chewing and opened her mouth in that round, hopeless expression of a child. Again, his hand left the wheel and gripped the back of her neck, and she sat motionless, gazing straight at him, her mouth open and the half-chewed mass of bread and meat lying upon her tongue. They reached Memphis in mid-afternoon. At the foot of the bluff, below Main Street, Popeye turned into a narrow street of smoke-grimed frame houses, with tiers of wooden galleries set a little back in grassless plots, with now and then a forlorn and hardy tree of some shabby species, gaunt, lop-branched magnolias, a stunted elm or a locust in grayish, cadaverous bloom, interspersed by rear ends of garages, a scrap heap in a vacant lot, a low-doored cavern of an equivocal appearance, where an oilcloth-covered counter and a row of backless stools, a metal coffee urn, and a fat man in a dirty apron with a toothpick in his mouth stood for an instant out of the gloom, with an effect as of a sinister and meaningless photograph poorly made. From the bluff, beyond a line of office buildings terraced sharply against the sun-filled sky, came a sound of traffic, motor horns, trolleys, passing high overhead on the river breeze. At the end of the street, a trolley materialized in the narrow gap with an effect as of magic and vanished with a stupendous clatter. On a second-story gallery, a young negress in her underclothes smoked a cigarette sullenly, her arms on the balustrade. Popeye drew up before one of the dingy three-story houses, the entrance of which was hidden by a dingy lattice cubicle leaning a little awry. In the grimy grass plot before it, two of those small, woolly, white, worm-like dogs, one with a pink, the other a blue ribbon about its neck, moved about with an air of sluggish and obscene paradox. In the sunlight, their coats looked as though they had been cleaned with gasoline. Later, Temple could hear them outside her door, whimpering and scuffing, or rushing thickly in when the Negro maid opened the door, climbing and sprawling onto the bed and into Miss Reba's lap, with wheezy, flatulent sounds billowing into the rich pneumasis of her breast and tonguing along the metal tankard which she waved in one ringed hand as she talked.
"Anybody in Memphis can tell you who Reba Rivers is. A skinny man on the street, cop or not. I've had some of the biggest men in Memphis right here in this house. Bankers, lawyers, doctors, all of them. I've had two police captains drinking beer in my dining room and a commissioner himself upstairs with one of my girls. They got drunk and crashed the door in on him and found him butt-naked dancing the Highland Fling. A man 50 years old, 7 foot tall, with a head like a peanut. He was a fine fella. He knew me. They all know Reba Rivers. Spend their money here like water they have. And oh me, I never double-crossed nobody, honey.
She drank beer, breathing thickly into the tankard, the other hand ringed with yellow diamonds as large as gravel, lost among the lush billows of her breast. Her slightest movement appeared to be accomplished by an expenditure of breath out of all proportion to any pleasure the movement could afford her. Almost as soon as they entered the house, she began to tell Temple about her asthma, toiling up the stairs in front of them, planting her feet heavily in worsted bedroom slippers, a wooden rosary in one hand and the tankard in the other. She had just returned from church in a black silk gown and a hat savagely flowered. The lower half of the tankard was still frosted with inner chill. She moved heavily from big thigh to thigh, the two dogs moiling underfoot, talking steadily back across her shoulder in a harsh, expiring, maternal voice.
Papa, I knew better than to bring you anywhere else but to my house. I've been after him for how many years that I've been after you to get a girl, honey? What I say, a young fella can't no more live without a girl, and...
Panting, she fell to cursing the dogs under her feet, stopping to shove them aside.
Get back down there, she said,
shaking the rosary at them. They snarled at her in vicious falsetto, baring their teeth, and she leaned against the wall in a thin aroma of beer, her hand to her breast, her mouth open, her eyes fixed in a glare of sad terror of all breathing as she besought breath. The tankard, a squat, soft gleam like dull silver, lifted in the gloom. The narrow stairwell turned back upon itself in a succession of niggard reaches. The light, falling through a thickly curtained door at the front and through a shuttered window at the rear of each stage, had a weary quality, a spent quality, defunctive, exhausted, a protracted weariness like a vitiated backwater beyond sunlight and the vivid noises of sunlight and day. There was a defunctive odor of irregular food, vaguely alcoholic, and Temple, even in her ignorance, seemed to be surrounded by a ghostly promiscuity of intimate garments, of discreet whispers of flesh, stale and oft-assailed and impregnable beyond each silent door which they passed. Behind her, about hers and Miss Reba's feet, the two dogs scrabbled in nappy gleams, their claws clicking on the metal strips which bound the carpet to the stairs. Later, lying in bed, a towel wrapped about her naked loins, she could hear them sniffing and whining outside the door. Her coat and hat hung on nails in the door, her dress and stockings lay upon a chair, and it seemed to her that she could hear the rhythmic splush-splush of the washing board somewhere. And she flung herself again in an agony for concealment, as she had when they took her knickers off.
Now, Miss Reba said. I bled for 4 days myself. It ain't nothing. Dr. Quinn'll stop it in 2 minutes, and Minnie'll have them all washed and pressed, and you won't never know it. That blood'll be worth $1,000 to you, honey.
She lifted the tankard, the flowers on her hat rigidly moribund, nodding in macabre was hail.
Us poor girls, she said.
The drawn shades cracked into a myriad pattern like old skin, blew faintly on the bright air, breathing into the room on waning surges the sound of Sabbath traffic, festive, steady, evanescent. Temple lay motionless in the bed, her legs straight and close, the covers to her chin and her face small and wan, framed in the rich sprawl of her hair. Miss Reba lowered the tankard, gasping for breath. In her hoarse, fainting voice, she began to tell Temple how lucky she was.
Every girl in the district has been trying to get him, honey. There's one. A little married woman slips down here sometimes. She offered Minnie $25 just to get him into the room. That's all. But do you think he'd so much as look at one of them? Girls that have took in $100 a night? No, sir. Spend his money like water. But do you think he'd look at one of them except to dance with her? I always knowed it wasn't going to be none of these here common whores he'd take. I'd tell them, I'd say, the one of yous that gets him will wear diamonds, I says. But it ain't going to be none of you common whores. And now Minnie'll have them washed and pressed until you won't know it.
I can't wear it again, Temple whispered. I can't.
No more you'll have to if you don't want. You can give them to Minnie. Though I don't know what she'll do with them, except maybe...
At the door, the dogs began to whimper louder. Feet approached. The door opened. A Negro maid entered, carrying a tray bearing a quart bottle of beer and a glass of gin, the dog surging in around her feet.
And tomorrow the stores will be open. Me and you will go shopping, like he said for us to. Like I said, the girl that gets him will wear diamonds. You just see if I wasn't...
She turned, mountainous. The tankard lifted as the two dogs scrambled onto the bed and then onto her lap, snapping viciously at one another. From their curled, shapeless faces, bead-like eyes glared with choleric ferocity. Their mouths gaped pinkly upon needle-like teeth.
"Reba," Miss Reba said, "get down. You, Mr. Benford,"
flinging them down, their teeth clicking about her hands.
"You just bite me, you. Did you get Miss... What's your name, honey? I didn't quite catch it."
"Temple," Temple whispered.
"I mean your first name, honey. We don't stand on no ceremony here."
"That's it. Temple. Temple Drake."
"You got a boy's name, ain't you? Miss Temple's things washed, Minnie?"
"Yes'm," the maid said. "It's drying now high in the stove."
She came with the tray, shoving the dogs gingerly aside while they clicked their teeth at her ankles.
"You wash it out good?"
"I had a time with it," Minnie said. "Seemed like that the most hardest blood of all to get."
With a convulsive movement, Temple flopped over, ducking her head beneath the covers. She felt Miss Reba's hand.
Now. Here, take your drink. This one's on me. I ain't gonna let no girl of Popeye's."
"I don't want any more," Temple said.
Now, Miss Reba said. "Drink it and you'll feel better."
She lifted Temple's head. Temple clutched the covers to her throat. Miss Reba held the glass to her lips. She gulped it, writhed down again, clutching the covers about her, her eyes wide and black above the covers.
"I bet you got that towel disarranged," Miss Reba said, putting her hand on the covers.
"No," Temple whispered. "It's all right. It's still there."
She shrank, cringing. They could see the cringing of her legs beneath the covers.
"Did you get Dr. Quinn, Minnie?"
Miss Reba said.
"Yes'm."
Minnie was filling the tankard from the bottle, a dull frosting pacing the rise of liquor within the metal.
"He say he don't make no Sunday afternoon calls." "Did you tell him who wanted him? Did you tell him Miss Reba wanted him?"
"Yes'm. He say he don't..."
"You go back and tell that, sir. You tell him I'll..." "No, wait."
She rose heavily.
"Sending a message like that back to me that can put him in jail three times over."
She waddled toward the door, the dogs crowding about the felt slippers. The maid followed and closed the door. Temple could hear Miss Reba cursing the dogs as she descended the stairs with terrific slowness. The sounds died away. The shades blew steadily in the windows with faint, rasping sounds. Temple began to hear a clock. It sat on the mantel above a grate filled with fluted green paper. The clock was of flowered china supported by four china nymphs. It had only one hand, scrolled and gilded, halfway between 10 and 11, lending to the otherwise blank face a quality of unequivocal assertion, as though it had nothing whatever to do with time. Temple rose from the bed. Holding the towel about her, she stole toward the door, her ears acute, her eyes a little blind with the strain of listening. It was twilight. In a dim mirror, a pellucid oblong of dusk set on end, she had a glimpse of herself like a thin ghost. A pale shadow moving in the uttermost profundity of shadow. She reached the door. At once she began to hear 100 conflicting sounds in a single converging threat, and she clawed furiously at the door until she found the bolt, dropping the towel to drive it home. Then she caught up the towel, her face averted, and ran back and sprang into the bed and clawed the covers to her chin and lay there, listening to the secret whisper of her blood. They knocked at the door for some time before she made any sound.
"It's the doctor, honey,"
Miss Reba panted harshly.
"Come on now, be a good girl."
"I can't,"
Temple said, her voice faint and small.
"I'm in bed."
"Come on now, he wants to fix you up,"
she panted harshly.
"My God, if I could just get one full breath again. I ain't had a full breath since..."
Low down, beyond the door, Temple could hear the dogs.
"Honey."
She rose from the bed, holding the towel about her. She went to the door, silently.
"Honey," Miss Reba said.
"Wait," Temple said. "Let me get back to the bed before... Let me get..."
"There's a good girl," Miss Reba said. "I knowed she was going to be good."
"Count 10 now," Temple said. "Will you count 10 now?"
she said against the wood. She slipped the bolt soundlessly, then she turned and sped back to the bed, her naked feet in pattering diminuendo. The doctor was a fattish man with thin, curly hair. He wore horn-rimmed glasses which lent to his eyes no distortion at all, as though they were of clear glass and worn for decorum's sake. Temple watched him across the covers, holding them to her throat.
"Make them go out," she whispered. "If they'll just go out."
"Now, now," Miss Reba said. "He's gonna fix you up."
Temple clung to the covers.
"If the little lady will just let,"
the doctor said. His hair evaporated finally from his brow. His mouth nipped in at the corners, his lips full and wet and red. Behind the glasses, his eyes looked like little bicycle wheels at dizzy speed, a metallic hazel. He put out a thick, white hand bearing a Masonic ring, haired over with fine reddish fuzz to the second knuckle joints. Cold air slipped down her body, below her thighs. Her eyes were closed. Lying on her back, her legs close together, she began to cry, hopelessly and passively, like a child in a dentist's waiting room.
"Now, now," Miss Reba said. "Take another sup of gin, honey. It'll make you feel better."
In the window, the cracked shade, yawning now and then with a faint rasp against the frame, let twilight into the room in fainting surges. From beneath the shade, the smoke-colored twilight emerged in slow puffs like signal smoke from a blanket, thickening in the room. The china figures which supported the clock gleamed in hushed, smooth flexions. Knee, elbow, flank, arm, and breast in attitudes of voluptuous lassitude. The glass face, become mirror-like, appeared to hold all reluctant light, holding in its tranquil depths a quiet gesture of moribund time, one-armed like a veteran from the wars. 10:30. Temple lay in the bed, looking at the clock, thinking about 10:30. She wore a too large gown of cerise crepe, black against the linen. Her hair was a black sprawl combed out now. Her face, throat, and arms outside the covers were gray. After the others left the room, she lay for a time, head and all beneath the covers. She lay so until she heard the door shut and the descending feet, the doctor's light, unceasing voice, and Miss Reba's labored breath grow twilight-colored in the dingy hall and die away. Then she sprang from the bed and ran to the door and shot the bolt and ran back and hurled the covers over her head again, lying in a tight knot until the air was exhausted. A final saffron-colored light lay upon the ceiling and the upper walls, tinged already with purple by the serrated palisade of Main Street, high against the western sky. She watched it fade as the successive yawns of the shade consumed it. She watched the final light condense into the clock face and the dial change from a round orifice in the darkness to a disk suspended in nothingness, the original chaos, and change in turn to a crystal ball holding in its still and cryptic depths the ordered chaos of the intricate and shadowy world, upon whose scarred flanks the old wounds whirl onward at dizzy speed into darkness lurking with new disasters. She was thinking about 10:30, the hour for dressing for a dance, if you were popular enough not to have to be on time. The air would be steamy with recent baths, and perhaps powder in the light like chaff in barn lofts, and they looking at one another, comparing, talking whether you could do more damage if you could just walk out on the floor like you were now. Some wouldn't, mostly ones with short legs. Some of them were all right, but they just wouldn't. They wouldn't say why. The worst one of all said boys thought all girls were ugly except when they were dressed. She said the snake had been seeing Eve for several days and never noticed her until Adam made her put on a fig leaf. "How do you know?" they said. And she said because the snake was there before Adam, because he was the first one thrown out of heaven. He was there all the time. But that wasn't what they meant. And they said, "How do you know?" And Temple thought of her kind of backed up against the dressing table and the rest of them in a circle around her with their combed hair and their shoulders smelling of scented soap and the light powder in the air and their eyes like knives until you could almost watch her flesh where the eyes were touching it and her eyes in her ugly face courageous and frightened and daring and they all saying, "How do you know?" until she told them and held up her hand and swore she had. That was when the youngest one turned and ran out of the room. She locked herself in the bath, and they could hear her being sick. She thought about 10:30 in the morning, Sunday morning, and the couple strolling toward church. She remembered it was still Sunday, the same Sunday, looking at the fading, peaceful gesture of the clock. Maybe it was 10:30 this morning, that 10:30. "Then I'm not here," she thought. "This is not me. Then I'm at school. I have a date tonight with," thinking of the student with whom she had the date. But she couldn't remember who it would be. She kept the dates written down in her Latin pony, so she didn't have to bother about who it was. She'd just dress, and after a while somebody would call for her. "So I'd better get up and dress," she said, looking at the clock. She rose and crossed the room quietly. She watched the clock face, but although she could see a warped turmoil of faint light and shadow and geometric miniature swinging across it, she could not see herself. "It's this nighty," she thought, looking at her arms, her breast rising out of a dissolving pall, beneath which her toes peeped in pale, fleet intervals as she walked. She drew the bolt quietly and returned to the bed and lay with her head cradled in her arms. There was still a little light in the room. She found that she was hearing her watch. Had been hearing it for some time. She discovered that the house was full of noises, seeping into the room muffled and indistinguishable, as though from a distance. A bell rang faintly and shrilly somewhere. Someone mounted the stairs in a swishing garment. The feet went on past the door and mounted another stair and ceased. She listened to the watch. A car started beneath the window with a grind of gears. Again the faint bell rang, shrill and prolonged. She found that the faint light yet in the room was from a street lamp. Then she realized that it was night, and that the darkness beyond was full of the sound of the city. She heard the two dogs come up the stairs in a furious scrabble. The noise passed the door and stopped, became utterly still, so still that she could almost see them crouching there in the dark against the wall, watching the stairs. One of them was named Mr. Something, Temple thought, waiting to hear Miss Reba's feet on the stairs. But it was not Miss Reba. They came too steadily and too lightly. The door opened. The dogs surged in two shapeless blurs and scuttled under the bed and crouched, whimpering.
"You dogs," Minnie's voice said. "You make me spill this."
The light came on. Minnie carried a tray.
"I got you some supper," she said. "Where them dogs gone to?"
"Under the bed," Temple said. "I don't want any." Minnie came and set the tray on the bed and looked down at Temple, her pleasant face knowing and placid.
"You want me to?"
she said, extending her hand. Temple turned her face quickly away. She heard Minnie kneel, cajoling the dogs snarling back at her with whimpering, asthmatic snarls and clicking teeth.
"Come out in there now,"
Minnie said.
"They know for Miss Reba do when she fixin' to get drunk. You, Mr. Benford."
Temple raised her head. "Mr. Benford?"
"He the one with the blue ribbon,"
Minnie said. Stooping, she flapped her arm at the dogs. They were backed against the wall at the head of the bed, snapping and snarling at her in mad terror.
"Mr. Benford was Miss Reba's man. Was landlord here 11 years until he died about 2 years ago. Next day, Miss Reba get these dogs. Name one Mr. Benford and other Miss Reba. Whenever she go to the cemetery, she start drinking like this evening. Then they both got to run. But Mr. Benford catch it sure enough. Last time she throw him out an upstairs window and go down and empty Mr. Benford's clothes closet and throw everything out in the street except what he buried in."
"Oh," Temple said, "no wonder they're scared. Let them stay under there. They won't bother me."
"Reckon I have to. Mr. Benford ain't gonna leave this room, not if he know it."
She stood again, looking down at Temple.
"Eat that supper," she said. "You feel better. I done slip you a drink of gin, too."
"I don't want any," Temple said, turning her face away. She heard Minnie leave the room. The door closed quietly. Under the bed, the dogs crouched against the wall in that rigid and furious terror. The light hung from the center of the ceiling. Beneath a fluted shade of rose-colored paper, browned where the bulb bulged it. The floor was covered by a figured maroon-tinted carpet tacked down in strips. The olive-tinted walls bore two framed lithographs. From the two windows, curtains of machine lace hung, dust-colored, like strips of lightly congealed dust set on end. The whole room had an air of musty stodginess. Decorum. In the wavy mirror of a cheap varnished dresser, as in a stagnant pool, there seemed to linger spent ghosts of voluptuous gestures and dead lusts. In the corner, upon a faded, scarred strip of oilcloth tacked over the carpet, sat a washstand bearing a flowered bowl and pitcher and a row of towels. In the corner behind it sat a slop jar, dressed also in fluted rose-colored paper. Beneath the bed, the dogs made no sound. Temple moved slightly. The dry complaint of mattress and springs died into the terrific silence in which they crouched. She thought of them, woolly, shapeless, savage, petulant, spoiled, the flatulent monotony of their sheltered lives snatched up without warning by an incomprehensible moment of terror and fear of bodily annihilation, at the very hands which symbolized by ordinary the licensed tranquility of their lives. The house was full of sounds. Indistinguishable, remote, they came into her with a quality of awakening, resurgence, as though the house itself had been asleep, rousing itself with dark. She heard something which might have been a burst of laughter in a shrill woman voice. Steamy odors from the tray drifted across her face. She turned her head and looked at it, at the covered and uncovered dishes of thick china. In the midst of them sat the glass of pale gin, a pack of cigarettes, and a box of matches. She rose on her elbow, catching up the slipping gown. She lifted the covers upon a thick steak, potatoes, green peas, rolls, an anonymous pinkish mass which some sense, elimination perhaps, identified as a sweet. She drew the slipping gown up again, thinking about them eating down at school in a bright uproar of voices and clattering forks, of her father and brothers at the supper table at home, thinking about the borrowed gown and Miss Reba saying that they would go shopping tomorrow. "And I've just got $2," she thought. When she looked at the food, she found that she was not hungry at all, didn't even want to look at it. She lifted the glass and gulped it empty, her face wry, and set it down and turned her face hurriedly from the tray, fumbling for the cigarettes. When she went to strike the match, she looked at the tray again and took up a strip of potato gingerly in her fingers and ate it. She ate another, the unlighted cigarette in her other hand. Then she put the cigarette down and took up the knife and fork and began to eat, pausing from time to time to draw the gown up onto her shoulder. When she finished eating, she lit the cigarette. She heard the bell again, then another in a slightly different key. Across a shrill rush of a woman's voice, a door banged. Two people mounted the stairs and passed the door. She heard Miss Reba's voice booming from somewhere and listened to her toiling slowly up the stairs. Temple watched the door until it opened and Miss Reba stood in it, the tankard in her hand. She now wore a bulging house dress and a widow's bonnet with a veil. She entered on the flowered felt slippers. Beneath the bed, the two dogs made a stifled, concerted sound of utter despair. The dress, unfastened in the back, hung lumpily about Miss Reba's shoulders. One ringed hand lay on her breast, the other held the tankard high. Her open mouth, studded with gold fillings, gaped upon the harsh labor of her breathing.
"Oh, God, oh, God," she said.
The dogs surged out from beneath the bed and hurled themselves toward the door in a mad scrabble. As they rushed past her, she turned and flung the tankard at them. It struck the door jamb, splashing up the wall, and rebounded with a forlorn clatter. She drew her breath, whistling, clutching her breast. She came to the bed and looked down at Temple through the veil.
"We was happy as two doves," she wailed, choking, her rings smoldering in hot glints within her billowing breast. "Then he had to go and die on me."
She drew her breath, whistling, her mouth gaped, shaping the hidden agony of her thwarted lungs, her eyes pale and round with stricken bafflement, protuberant.
"As two doves,"
she roared in a harsh, choking voice. Again, time had overtaken the dead gesture behind the clock crystal. Temple's watch on the table beside the bed said 10:30. For 2 hours she had lain undisturbed, listening. She could distinguish voices now from below stairs. She had been hearing them for some time, lying in the room's musty isolation. Later a mechanical piano began to play. Now and then she heard automobile brakes in the street beneath the window. Once two voices, quarreling bitterly, came up and beneath the shade. She heard two people, a man and a woman, mount the stairs and enter the room next hers. days. Then she heard Miss Reba toil up the stairs and pass her door, and lying in the bed, her eyes wide and still, she heard Miss Reba hammering at the next door with the metal tankard and shouting into the wood. Beyond the door, the man and woman were utterly quiet. So quiet that Temple thought of the dogs again, thought of them crouching against the wall under the bed in that rigid fury of terror and despair. She listened to Miss Reba's voice shouting hoarsely into the blank wood. It died away into terrific gasping, then it rose again in the gross and virile cursing of a man. Beyond the wall, the man and woman made no sound. Temple lay staring at the wall beyond which Miss Reba's voice rose again as she hammered at the door with the tankard. Temple neither saw nor heard her door when it opened. She just happened to look toward it after how long she did not know, and saw Popeye standing there, his hat slanted across his face. Still, without making any sound, he entered and shut the door, and shot the bolt and came toward the bed. As slowly she began to shrink into the bed, drawing the covers up to her chin, watching him across the covers. He came and looked down at her. She writhed slowly in a cringing movement, cringing upon herself in as complete an isolation as though she were bound to a church steeple. She grinned at him, her mouth warped over the rigid, placative porcelain of her grimace. When he put his hand on her, she began to whimper.
"No, no," she whispered. "He said I can't now," he said.
He jerked the covers back and flung them aside. She lay motionless, her palms lifted, her flesh beneath the envelope of her loins cringing rearward in furious disintegration, like frightened people in a crowd. When he advanced his hand again, she thought he was going to strike her. Watching his face, she saw it beginning to twitch and jerk like that of a child about to cry. And she heard him begin to make a whimpering sound. He gripped the top of the gown. She caught his wrists and began to toss from side to side, opening her mouth to scream. His hand clapped over her mouth. And gripping his wrist, the saliva drooling between his fingers, her body thrashing furiously from thigh to thigh, she saw him crouching beside the bed, his face wrung above his absent chin, his bluish lips protruding as though he were blowing upon hot soup, making a high, whinnying sound like a horse. Beyond the wall, Miss Reba filled the hall, the house, with a harsh, choking uproar of obscene cursing.